now, years later, and with years of reflection on these things, I can still discern in that earliest experience many of the motifs that have persisted through the years and remained mysterious. At one point during the evening, Dennis and I both seemed to be able to see and describe the same hallucination. Off and on over the years, this has happened several times with psilocybin, and the wonder of it does not change. Even in those early mushroom experiences at La Chirera, there was an aura of the animate and the strange that focused in the idea that the mushroom was somehow more than a plant hallucinogen, or even a shamanic ally of the classical sort, that it was in fact a kind of intelligent entity, not of Earth, alien, and able to present itself during the trance as a presence in the inward-turned perceptions of its beholder. In the days following, our lives, the lives of my brother and myself, underwent a tremendous and bizarre transformation. It was not until Jacques Vallée had written of the absurd element that is invariably a part of the situation in which contact with a UFO occurs that I found the courage to again examine the events at La Chirera, to try to fit them into some general pattern. I have told various parts of our story over the years, never revealing the entire incredible structure to any one listener because of what I knew it seemed to imply about our mental condition during the time of the experience. Any story of UFO contact is going to be incredible enough by itself, but central to our story are the hallucinogenic drugs that we had been experimenting with. The very fact that we were involved with such drugs as a method of triggering UFO contacts would make any story we might eventually have to tell seem highly dubious to anyone not sympathetic to the use of hallucinogens. There were other difficulties with telling this story. The events at La Chirera generated a great deal of controversy and subsequent bitterness among the participants, because several ideas of what was taking place were represented, each basing itself on data unavailable or deemed ipso facto irrelevant by the competing interpretations. We were poorly prepared for the events that overwhelmed us. We began as naive observers of something, we knew not what, and because our involvement with this phenomenon went on for many days, we were able to observe many aspects of it, and I was able to satisfy myself that generally the method of approach which is told of here is effective for triggering whatever it is that we call the UFO contact experience. It may also be dangerous. The journal entry above refers to our first Strafaria trip at La Chirera. It occurred on the 22nd of February, 71, only a little more than 24 hours after our arrival at La Chirera, following the four-day walk through the jungle from San Jose del Encanto on the Rio Caraparaná. That entry makes it clear that I was spellbound. It was the last thing that I could bring myself to write for several weeks, though I did not realize it as I sat writing in the sunlight that morning. I was suffused with contentment. I knew only that the mushroom was the best hallucinogen I had ever had, that it had a quality of aliveness that I had never known before. It seemed to open doorways into places that I had assumed would always be closed to me because of my insistence on analysis and realism. I had never had psilocybin before, and was amazed at the difference from LSD, which seemed more abrasively psychoanalytic and personality-oriented. In contrast, the mushroom seemed so full of merry elfin energy that casting off into the drug trance was made more enticing. Nothing of the magnitude of the forces even then gathering around our small expedition was sensed by me. I was thinking in terms like, it's great that these mushrooms are here. Even if we don't find Ukuhe or Yahe, we will always have them to fall back on, and certainly they are interesting. Our plan was to spend about 3 months slowly getting to know the botanical and social situation among the Witoto, living traditionally in a village about 14 kilometers down a trail from the mission on the Agara Parana at La Chorrera. We knew Ukuhe was secret, and we were in no hurry. So the day after our first mushroom experience was spent checking our equipment after the rigors of the overland walk and generally relaxing in the casita to which Father Jose Maria, the Capuchin in charge, had kindly shown us. We gathered more mushrooms that afternoon and dried them near the cooking fire. That evening I pulverized them and made them into a snuff. It was delicious, like some chocolate-related essence. We all snuffed it, and it was generally thought a success. I felt elated, very pleased with everything, and impressed with what an extraordinarily beautiful place we had come to be in. We decided that we would take mushrooms again that night. It was a different sort of experience. As we sat around waiting to get stoned, there was a lot of nitpicking going on between Vanessa and Dennis. Up to this point, Dennis had not come forward as a personality at all. Finally, he had apparently had enough of Vanessa and said, "You know, you're pretty weird, and I'm going to tell you why." I was amazed because as he talked, he gave perfect expression to my own thoughts on Vanessa. There was no tension in the situation for me. Someone else was rapping it down to her how she was out of line. But then, after a few minutes, I felt very odd because I felt like Sia. Weird. I feel like this other person. I don't know what this guy feels like, but I feel the way I imagine he must feel. We were trying to smoke some grass, and then I said, "Smoking makes it easier to hallucinate. Smoke to get higher." Dennis was having trouble with the matches, fumbling and fumbling. "What's the problem? Just light the match. Would you light the match?" We were all crossed up, and so we came down. It was disappointing. The next day was spent relaxing, catching up on insect and plant collecting, washing clothes, and chatting with the priest and brother in residence. Through them, we put out the word that we were interested in people who knew things about medicinal plants. That afternoon, a young Witoto named Basilio came to the casita, and having heard of our interest from the priest, offered to take us to see his father, a shaman with a local reputation. Basilio assumed that we were interested in yahe. It is the better known hallucinogen in the area. It is generally available for the asking. The Ukuhe was a much more sensitive subject. At La Chorrera, a month or two before we had arrived, there had been a murder. Actually, several murders and attempted murder. It all had to do with Ukuhe. Supposedly, a shaman had murdered one of two shaman brothers by painting the top rung of a ladder with the DMT resin. When the victim had grabbed the rung, the resin had absorbed through his fingers, and he had gotten vertigo and had fallen, breaking his neck. The shaman, whose brother had been killed, struck back by causing an accident. The alleged murderer's wife, daughter, and grandchild had been in a canoe above the Choro, and unaccountably unable to reach the shore, they had been swept over it. It was said they were victims of magic. Only the wife had lived through it. It was not the time to be asking about Ukuhe. Basilio insisted that the yahe was a day upriver at his father's maloka. He had a small canoe, so only two of us could go with him. After consultation, it was decided that Ev and I should go. We left at once for the river, and I took my film canister of snuff with us. Calm was the day and blue the sky. An extraordinary peace and depthless serenity seemed to touch everything. It was as if the whole earth was softly exhaling its exhilaration. Had such a mood developed no further, it would have passed into being but a pleasant memory. In the light of later events, I now look back on that afternoon of deepening contentment and almost bucolic relaxation as the first faint stirring of the current that was shortly to sweep me toward unimaginably titanic emotions. Our new Witoto acquaintances were very kind, a different sort from the Witoto of San Jose del Encanto. We were shown their cultivated yahe plants and given cuttings and a bundle of the vines so that we could make our own ayahuasca. Basilio described to us his own single experience with yahe when, several years before, after days of fever from an unknown cause, he had taken it with his father. He described the yahe as a cold water infusion, rare for that area, where vigorous boiling usually plays a part in the preparation. After soaking the shredded yahe for a day and a night, the unboiled water had become hallucinogenically potent. There had been many fences to cross in the visions, a sense of flying. The father had seen the bad air from the mission that had weakened his son. The mission was recognized as a place of ill omen. After this experience, Basilio recovered his health and was less often at the mission, he told us. It was all very interesting, our first exposure to field conditions, and it accorded well with our data on yahe usage and beliefs in the area. We hung our hammocks in a small hut near the main maloca that night. I dreamed of fences and the pasture back at the mission. The next morning early, we were rowed back to the mission by Basilio. Our collections of Banisteriopsis were reason for pride, but again I felt the elation whose depth could not be found. Peculiar, I muttered to myself as we swung in sight of the mission, overlooking its lake, and placed on a sunny hill with a row of date palms sweeping up from the boat landing. Very peculiar. Chapter 5, A Brush with the Other. Returning to our friends, we learned that in the few hours that we had been gone, some teachers expected to arrive to teach in the mission school had finally appeared. They had been ferried in by a bush pilot, the notorious George Salikas, who served as La Chorrera's emergency link to the outside world and who brought the mail once a month. We were out of lodging, for it had been the professore's quarters that we had been staying in. Not precisely out of lodging, the priest having offered us the temporary use of a run-down hut that stood on stilts on a small rise below the mission, but well above the broad lake that is caused by the Choro, which gave La Chorrera its name. The word means narrow channel or chute. It was in this small hut, instantly christened the Knoll House, that we proposed to live while we arranged to move further into the nearby jungle and away from the somewhat confining atmosphere of the mission. We rested, passed a joint around, and planned our next move. In conversations with the brother, Dave and Vanessa had learned that there was a quite sturdy Witoto house unused and lying down the trail toward the village where our hopes for Ukuhe centered. It normally stood empty, but was now occupied by the people who had brought their children to the mission for the beginning of the school year. It is the practice of the Witoto to leave their children in the keeping of the padres for 6 or more months out of the year, the effect of which on the social self-image of the children is easily imagined. Children were coming from all directions, being brought by their parents who would then return to their own villages until time to reclaim the children. These times of gathering at the mission at the beginning and end of the school year are high points of the Witoto social swirl and an excuse for soccer games and night bailes for the Witoto are inveterate dancers. We were in the midst of such a gathering time, but in a few days all the families would leave and there would be ample empty housing in the jungle. Dave, Dennis, and Vanessa had already inspected one place and determined it to be ideal, close to good insect and plant collecting, and definitely in the jungle itself. We transferred our equipment to the Knoll house and reslung our hammocks. It was cramped, but would do until we could move into the forest. Then, almost in a collective motion, we set out in the early afternoon to the pasture behind the mission. Find the mushrooms. That was the thought on everyone's mind. We returned at evening to the house, each with 6 or 8 carefully chosen specimens. These we ate. And then, as the evening's trip deepened, we smoked joints rolled out of shavings of the freshly gathered Banisteriopsis kapi. The kapi smoke was delicious. It smelled like light incense, and each toke synergized beautiful slow-motion volleys of delicate hallucinations, which we immediately dubbed vegetable television. Each burst of imagery would last about 15 minutes and subside. Then it was time to take another hit of the kapi smoke. The effect persisted a couple of hours. We triggered it repeatedly and excitedly discussed it as an example of the sort of things that sophisticated shamanic technicians have been whipping up for each other's amazement since the late Paleolithic. Our conversation drifted toward and around the possibilities of violations of normal physics and the psychological versus naive realist views of shamanic phenomena, especially the obsidian liquids that ayahuasqueros are said to produce on the surface of their skins and use to look into time. The question of whether or not such things are possible is actually a more gut issue in disguise. The issue of whether what we moderns have remaining to learn about the nature of reality is really not very much and will require only light fine-tuning of our way of looking at things, versus the idea that we know very little and our understanding is very crude, missing the point entirely about the nature of our situation in being. Conversation waxed hot and heavy. Ev, Dennis, and I, passionate defenders of the latter view, Vanessa and Dave insisting on a psychological reductionist approach to the unusual events. Ideology forgotten, they then denounced the passion of our commitment as obsession, and we responded by saying that they repressed the real power of the unconscious, and that if they were with us trying to vindicate some behaviorist, materialist view of man, then they would be in for a surprise, and so on. Tension had simmered under the surface for weeks, and the life of an expedition is full of stress and aggravated difference. But I believe that the real point of tension even then was the sense of something in the mushroom experience that was pulling everyone toward it, or at least precipitating a situation where one had to decide whether to go deeper into a dimension whose outline ahead of us could not be seen. Each trip was a learning experience with an unexpected conclusion. The three of us were delighted, psychedelic, ready to strip down and climb into the alchemical fountain and take the measure of the thing from the inside. Call it Faustian, call it obsessed, that was our position. I called it continuing the program of investigations that brought us to La Chorrera in the first place. For Vanessa and Dave, the reality of the dimension we were exploring, or rather our growing insistence that somehow it was a dimension with elements more than psychological, was operating like a threat. There we were, a group sharing a common set of symbols, completely isolated in the jungle, struggling with an epistemological problem upon whose solution our sanity would eventually seem to depend. And so, and in short, Dave and Vanessa withdrew from us, withdrew from the excited, speculative conversations with their intimations of the possibility of being overwhelmed from the unseen. There were no arguments or scenes, but a tacit and mutual understanding that a fork in the road had been reached and that some of us were committed to going deeper into the idea systems of the mushroom trance, and some were disturbed by the sudden depth of things and preferred to pass on this occasion. The cramped Knoll house and the polarizing of two approaches toward further tripping combined to inspire Vanessa to expand her checker-playing contacts with the police garrison of three very displaced young Colombians. After several closely fought games, she had a full-fledged invitation to relieve our crowded conditions by moving with Dave into an unused riverside house nominally in the care of the police. Later, this house, which was at the river landing of La Chorrera, would be the site of my own UFO encounter, but that was in a future long days away from the afternoon of our vegetable television trip when Vanessa and Dave took down their hammocks and moved down the hill to the promptly named Riverside House. It was a beautiful day and their departure was friendly. They would spend more time in the water now, Vanessa laughed. It was the sixth day of our residence at La Chorrera. We had taken the mushrooms three times. We were healthy, relaxed, and delighted with ourselves for having come so far in such good shape. There were insects and plants to collect and the lake beneath the Choro to swim in. My new relationship with Ev seemed promising and well launched by then. We were being lulled by the warm tropical sun in the depthless blue sky. Something was about to happen. After the departure of our two friends, we each lay in our own hammock, lost in thought as the heat and insect shrill built toward midday. My journal entries had already ceased, my busy writing now replaced by long flights of reverie, dizzying and beautiful, the faint traces of the deepening of the contact, though I did not then recognize it for that. Another warm night was upon us, and we slept long and well. When the morning ground fogs had burned away, this new day was revealed to be as pristine and as flawless as the days always seem to be in this marvelously beautiful jungle-isolated settlement. Each day seemed like a pearl born from the warm and starry night preceding. We used that day to explore the lake edge in the direction of the Choro. It is an extraordinary landform. The Choro, with its abrupt narrowing of the Igalaparaná and sudden terrible increase of power and speed, is impressive enough. But the lake into which the Choro empties its waters is no mere catch basin for the rapids. Rather, it is the site of some ancient geological catastrophe that shattered the basaltic layer deep beneath the Earth's surface, peeling back a great hole and laying thousands of house-sized rock fragments on the cliff-edged northern side of the lake. The mission is perched on the top of this basaltic knoll and is the highest point in the immediate vicinity. We made our way along the bluffs leading to the Choro, their steepness increasing finally to the point that we could go no further, but at that distance the ground was shuddering with throbbing reverberations of the millions of tons of water cascading through the rock walls of the Choro nearby. Unusual ground-clinging plants seemed endemic there in that turbulent atmosphere of mist-whipped sand and thundering noise. The feeling of being so small among such sharply shattered stone and close to such energy was eerie and somewhat disturbing. I felt a very considerable amount of relief as we climbed hand over hand up the bluffs and made our way back through the meadows and pastures that the mission had cleared over the years with the free labor of the Witoto children. Once back on level ground, and still well within the aura of sound made by the Choro, we rested. There, on the point of land overlooking the entire surrounding area, the mission had established a small cemetery. Within the rudely fenced hexagonal area, perhaps 2 dozen graves, many of them obviously of children, were eroding away. The shocking red of the lateritic soil was laid bare here. It was a place touched with sad loneliness, even on a perfect sunny day. Our respite finished, we hurried away from the odd combination of emptiness, solitude, and the distant roar of moving water. Our walk, and exposure to so much sun and stone, sent us as if by instinct toward the unbroken green wall of the jungle across the pastures behind the mission. Broad sandy trails led to the system of Witoto, Bora, and Muinani villages that are the indigenous component of Commissaria Amazonas, the rest being a few missions, police, and unclassifiables, traders mostly, and ourselves. We wandered down the trail, checked on our home to be, and found it still occupied. Returning through the pastures under a spectacular sunset, we gathered more mushrooms, enough for Ev, Dennis, and me to each take more than we ever had before. How much? Perhaps 20 mushrooms apiece. It was during that walk through the pasture that I noticed for the first time, or at least mentioned for the first time, that everything was very beautiful, and I felt so good that there was a strange sense of being in a movie, or somehow larger than life. Even the sky seemed to have a slight fisheye lens effect, as though everything was slightly cinematic. What was this? Was it a slight distortion of space brought on by accumulating levels of psilocybin? Psilocybin can induce similar kinds of perceptual distortions. I felt 10 feet high, just a touch of the superhuman. It was odd, but very pleasing. Back at the Knoll house, we kindled a fire and boiled rice for a light supper. Rain was falling intermittently. After dinner, we smoked and waited long, thinking that Vanessa and Dave might visit. Finally, it began to drizzle a bit harder, and so we drew ourselves forward and each ate a large pile of mushrooms. The onset of the stropharia was rapid and the hallucinations very vivid. But after an hour or so, the experience did not seem to be particularly different from the earlier trips, in spite of the larger dose. We had come out of our reveries and were conversing softly about our reactions. Dennis complained that he felt blocked from a deep connection by concern for our father in Colorado, whether or not our last messages to him before setting off down the Rio Putumayo had reached him before he went on his vacation. Dennis seemed melancholy, a state of homesickness in combination with a hallucinogen, I supposed. I tried to reassure him, and we talked softly in the darkness for several minutes. He said that his trip consisted of many things, a suffusing inner heat and a strange audial buzzing that gave him, so he said, insight into audial and linguistic phenomena that I had experienced on DMT and described to him before. I asked him to imitate the sounds that he was hearing, but he seemed to think it not possible. While we talked, the drizzle had lifted somewhat, and we could faintly hear the sound of a transistor radio being carried by someone who had chosen the let-up in the storm to make their way up the hill on a small path that passed a few feet from our hut. Our conversation stopped, and we listened as the small radio sound drew near and then began to fade. At that moment, Dennis gave forth with a very machine-like, loud, dry buzz. His body became stiff in a few seconds in which this occurred. After a moment's silence, he broke into a frightened series of excited questions.
What happened?
What happened? And most memorably, I don't want to become a giant insect. He was very disturbed by what had happened, and Ev and I both talked to him and attempted to calm him. It was obvious that what to us had seemed only a strange sound had had far different effects on the person who made it. I understood his predicament because it was familiar to me from DMT experiences where a kind of glossolalia of thought that seemed to me the very embodiment of meaning seemed mere gibberish when verbalized and heard by other people. Dennis spoke of tremendous energy in the sound and said that he had felt it like a physical force of some kind. We discussed it for several minutes, and finally Dennis decided that he wished to attempt the effect again. This he did, but for a much shorter time. He again reported that the subjective experience was of great energy being unleashed. He said that he felt as though he might leave the ground if he directed his voice downward. We discussed the effect in terms of sound possibly having a synergistic effect on metabolizing drugs. Dennis vowed that from the inside it felt like the acquisition of a shamanic power of some sort. He began pacing around and wishing that Vanessa would appear out of the gloom with her skepticism, which he felt would crumble when confronted with his testimony of the reality of a strange effect. I told him that she would only think of it as a strange sound in combination with a drug she was growing uncertain of. At one point, he became so excited that we all three left the hut and stood looking out into the pitch darkness. Dennis was contemplating going immediately to find Vanessa and Dave to discuss with them what had happened. Finally, a bewildered Ev and I convinced him to return to the hut and leave it all for the morning. Once back in the hut, there was more talk and attempts to figure out what was going on. I felt Dennis' amazement was perfectly reasonable. My own encounter with the audial and linguistic powers of the tryptamine drugs had been what had originally sent me looking into hallucinogens and their place in nature. It is an incredible experience to see all that you believe about reality changed around by these compounds. It is edifying, and excitement is a reasonable reaction. My brother and I had been close over the years, and especially close since our mother's death, yet there were experiences that I had had while traveling in Asia that we had not yet shared. To calm us all, and to argue for the universality of the kind of experience he had just had, I told the following story. Chapter 6, Kathmandu Interlude. 2 years before, during the spring and summer of 69, I lived in Nepal and studied the Tibetan language. The wave of interest in Buddhist studies was just beginning, so that those of us in Nepal with Tibetan interests were a tightly knit group. My purpose in studying Tibetan was different from that of most Westerners involved with the language in Nepal. They were nearly all interested in some aspect of Mahayana Buddhist thought, while I was interested in the religious tradition that antedated the introduction of Buddhism into Tibet in the 7th century. The indigenous pre-Buddhist religion of Tibet was a kind of shamanism closely related to the classical shamanism of Siberia. Tibetan folk shamanism is called pun, and it continues to be practiced today in the mountainous area of Nepal that borders Tibet. Practitioners of Pun are usually despised by the Buddhist community, being thought of as heretics and generally low types. My interest in Pun and its practitioners, the Punpo, arose out of an interest in Tibetan painting. It is a commonplace of such painting that the most fantastic, extravagant, and ferocious images are drawn from the pre-Buddhist substratum of folk imagery. The terrifying, multi-armed and multi-headed guardians of the Buddhist teaching, called Dharmapalas, with their aureoles of flame and light, are autochthonous Pun deities whose allegiance to the late arriving Buddhist religion is maintained only by powerful spells and rituals which bind and secure these forceful demons. It seemed to me that the shamanic tradition that spawns such outlandish and fantastic images must have at some time had the knowledge of a hallucinogenic plant. Shamanic ecstasy in Siberia was attained through the use of Amanita muscaria, and R.G. Wasson has made a good case for the use of the same mushroom in Vedic India. Since Tibet is situated roughly between these two areas, it did not seem impossible that before the coming of Buddhism, hallucinogens were part of the indigenous shamanic tradition. Amanita muscaria was only one of several plants that might have served as a hallucinogen in ancient Tibet. Pagaman harmala of the Zygophilaceae is another hallucinogen. It, like Banisteriopsis copy, contains the hallucinogenic alkaloid harmine in considerable quantities and is probably a hallucinogen by itself. Certainly in combination with a DMT-containing plant, of which the flora of India boasts several, Arundodonax, for example, it should yield a strong hallucinogen whose composition would not differ chemically from the ayahuasca and yahe brews of Amazonas. My interest in Tibetan painting and hallucinogenic shamanism led me to Nepal. I had learned that there were refugee camps in Nepal and near Simla in India whose populations were nearly entirely outclassed Punpo, unwelcome in the camps where Buddhist refugees were housed. I wanted to learn from the Punpo whatever they still retained of any knowledge of hallucinogens that they might once have had. I was convinced that the original source of the fantastic images in Tibetan painting must be a shamanic use of plant hallucinogens. I wished, in my naivete, to prove this idea and to write a monograph about it. As soon as I arrived in Asia, the enormity of the task and effort that it would require were seen more nearly in their correct proportions. My proposed project was actually an outline for a life of scholarly research. Naturally, I found that nothing could be done at all until I was familiar with the Tibetan language. I put aside all the ideas I had hoped eventually to research, and instead resolved simply to dedicate myself to learning as much Tibetan as I could in the few months that circumstances gave me in Nepal. I moved out of Kathmandu, away from the pleasures of the hashish dens and the social swirl of the international community of travelers, smugglers, and adventurers that had made Kathmandu its own. I moved to Bodhnath, a small village of great antiquity a few miles east of Kathmandu and recently flooded with Tibetans from Hwasa, people who spoke the Hwasa dialect that is understood throughout the Himalayas. The people of the village were Buddhist, and I made my arrangements to study with the monks there without mentioning my interest in the Punpo, a tradition considered by them debased and pagan. I sought lodging and came to terms with Denbadu, the local miller and a Niwari. He agreed to rent a room on the third floor of his prosperous adobe house which fronted the muddy main street of Bodhnath. I struck a bargain with a local girl who agreed to bring me fresh water each day, and I settled comfortably in. I whitewashed the adobe walls of my room, commissioned a huge mosquito net in the market in Kathmandu, and arranged my books and small Tibetan bench inside. I was very comfortable and treasured my existence as a traveler and scholar. Tashi Yaltsin Lama was my teacher. He was a very kind and understanding Gelugpa. In spite of his age, he would arrive every morning promptly at 7 for our 2-hour lesson. I was like a child. We began with penmanship and the alphabet. Each morning after the Lama departed, I would study for several more hours, and then the rest of the day was my own. I explored the King's Game Sanctuary further east of Bodhnath and the Hindu Ghats at nearby Pashupatinath. I also made the acquaintance of the few Westerners that were living in the vicinity. Among those whom I met, there were an English couple of my own age. They were self-consciously fascinating. He was thin and blonde, with an aquiline nose and an arch manner. He was the model product of the British public school system, haughty and urbane, but eccentric and often hilarious. She was small and unhealthily thin. Scrawny is the word I use to describe her to myself. She was from Somerset, red-haired and wild-tempered, cynical, and like her companion, with a razor wit. They had both been disowned by their families, were traveling hippies, as we all were then. Their relationship was bizarre. They had stuck together from England, but the relaxing of tension which arrival in bucolic Nepal had brought had been too much for their fragile liaison. Now they lived apart, he at one end of Bodhnath and she alone at the other, and they met only for the combined purpose of visiting someone or of abrading each other's nerves. In that exotic setting, they managed to charm me completely. Whether alone or together, I was always interested to pause from my studies and to pass some time with them. Naturally, we discussed my work at times, and since it involved hallucinogens, they were very interested, being familiar with LSD from their days in the London scene. We discovered that we had mutual friends in India, that we all loved the novels of Thomas Hardy. We became fast friends. It was a pleasant time. During this time, my personally evolved method for probing the shamanic dimension was to smoke DMT at the peak point of an LSD experience. I would do this whenever I took LSD, which was quite occasionally, and it would allow me to enter the tryptamine dimension for a slightly extended period of time. As the summer solstice of 69 approached, I laid plans for such an experiment. I would take LSD the night of the solstice and sit up all night on my roof smoking hashish and stargazing. I mentioned my plan to my two English friends, and they expressed a desire to join me. This was fine with me, but the problem was that there was not enough reliable LSD for them to take any. My own tiny supply had arrived in Kathmandu, prophetically hidden inside a small ceramic mushroom mailed from Aspen. Almost as a joke, I suggested that they substitute the seeds of the Himalayan Datura Metal, for the LSD. Daturas are the source of a number of tropane alkaloids, scopolamine, hyoscyamine, etc., compounds which produce a pseudo-hallucinogenic effect. They give an impression of flying or of confronting visions, but all in a very hard to keep control of and difficult to recollect later dimension. The seeds of Datura Metal are used in Nepal by sadhus, or wandering hermits and holy men, so their use was not unknown in the area. Nevertheless, my suggestion was made facetiously, since the difficulty of controlling Datura is legendary. To my surprise, my friends agreed that this was something they wanted to do. We arranged that they would arrive at my home at 6 on the appointed day. When the evening finally came, I moved my blankets and pipes up to the roof of the building. From there I could command a fine view of the surrounding village with its enormous stupa with staring eyes. The upper golden levels of the stupa were at that time encased in scaffolding where repairs necessitated by a lightning strike suffered some months previously were going on. The white domed bulk of the stupa gave the adobe mud village of Bodhnath a Saussurean and unearthly quality. Further away, rising up many thousands of feet, I could see the great Annapurna Range. In the middle distance, the land was a patchwork of emerald paddy.